Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The CDC says there are now two confirmed cases of the new coronavirus in the United States, one in Washington State, the other in Chicago. The virus has already killed more than 25 people and sickened hundreds more in China, where it started. The government there is quickly building a new 1,000-bed hospital in the city of Wuhan. That's the epicenter of the outbreak and one of several cities that are on lockdown. No travel in or out. Joining us now is NPR's Emily Feng. She's in Beijing. Emily, these lockdowns are affecting millions of people. Tell us more about the scale of the response to this virus.
35 million people, actually, which is a huge number. They did not do that even during the 2003 SARS epidemic. And what this tells us is that authorities are taking this more seriously, perhaps, in the initial phases than they did in previous academics. Perhaps they're learning from some of the mistakes they made in the past. But yeah, it's a huge, huge area. They first began with Wuhan, which is this industrial port city of about 11 million people. It's where the new coronavirus originated. That has seen the strictest lockdown yet. Soldiers were guarding the train station yesterday. Airports have completely canceled all their flights. The highways today have been completely sealed off. Now there are at least seven other cities surrounding Wuhan in the same province that have also seen different degrees of a lockdown. So roads blocked, but people still were allowed to pass through as long as they were screened today. Train stations, though, shut down and long-distance buses shut down. But you've seen people remain calm, though it took some security to make sure that people were not leaving. There were some sporadic reports today of people who still tried to get past the barricade were tracked down by public security and brought back.
Wow. How about this new hospital in Wuhan? They want to build it in just a matter of days. How is that going to work?
Well, so they want to build it in less than a week, which is astonishing. They say they're going to do it by using prefabricated blocks. It's more of a makeshift treatment and quarantine center than it is a functioning hospital. But this is a measure that they also took in 2003 during the SARS epidemic. It was seen as an extreme but really important step towards eventually curtailing that outbreak. So this measure has been welcomed in China.
What about other hospitals? How are the other hospitals in China dealing with what must be an influx of patients who are either sick or think that they're sick with the coronavirus?
Yeah, it's winter, so people will have the normal colds and flus. Maybe it's not coronavirus, but certainly people are not taking any chances. And in particular, Hubei province, where Wuhan is located, has seen its hospitals become totally overloaded with people who think that they might be sick with this new virus. A few days ago, people were getting turned away. They were just given some oral medication. If symptoms were really bad, maybe an IV drip. And it's possible that a number of coronavirus cases were overlooked because there just weren't enough doctors to see these patients. Chinese health authorities and Hubei provincial authorities have said yesterday and today that they're sending more doctors over. They're opening more beds. They're creating space in hospitals so that that doesn't happen anymore. Actually, today, China's army said it was going to send over 40 army medics to supplement the dwindling medical staff in Wuhan to help out.
Now, you're in Beijing, a huge city that's far from the epicenter of the coronavirus. Are people there worried? Are they wearing masks?
They are. So first of all, Beijing is usually empty around Chinese Lunar New Year, which begins Saturday officially. Many people aren't actually from Beijing. They go home over the holidays, so it's going to be a little emptier than usual. But I think this year around, it's been particularly empty, and the people that have stayed, almost to a T, everyone is wearing a mask. I've gone to several pharmacies over the last 2 days just to see if I could get hand sanitizer, rubbing alcohol, various kinds of surgical masks. It's almost impossible to get the former, rubbing alcohol and hand sanitizer now. It's completely sold out.
Emily, as this crisis continues to develop, just remind us, what do we know at this point? And I know they're still trying to figure out what they can. What do we know at this point about how this coronavirus started?
We still don't know that much. At least there's not that much information publicly available. It's thought to have started at this open-air market in the city of Wuhan. Various theories have been put out that it originated from wild cats that were sold at this market or snakes that were sold at this market. None of those theories have been proven yet. Today, there were new cases of coronavirus that were confirmed in which the patients didn't exhibit the predicted symptoms of previous coronavirus victims. So at this point, authorities still don't know, one, how the virus is transmitted. They know that people can transmit it to other people, but through what kinds of methods, people are not totally sure. And the symptoms keep changing. So it's been very difficult to even diagnose this this disease.
That's NPR's Emily Feng in Beijing. Emily, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, in Washington, the coronavirus was the subject of an all-Senate briefing this morning before lawmakers filed into the Senate for the final day of Democrats' opening arguments in the impeachment trial of President Trump. Scott Wong is senior staff writer at The Hill in Washington. And Scott, we're going to get to impeachment in just a minute. But first, you spoke with senators coming out of this coronavirus meeting. What did they tell you?
Well, they just got a briefing from these Trump administration officials. Obviously, people are taking this very seriously. The CDC, NIH, and State Department all briefed behind closed doors when these senators emerged. They talked about how this was not yet a public health crisis here in the United States, but they were informed about this now second case in Chicago. In fact, Dick Durbin, the senior senator from Illinois, said he had no idea about this case until he sat in that briefing and heard from the Trump administration officials themselves. Now, what they're saying is three things. They're saying that this they believe this virus is transmitted. It's an airborne virus. They believe that there it has a two-week incubation period. And they also believe that it can remain on objects after somebody sneezes or coughs, for example. And so these are some of the early things we're learning about this virus. But obviously, this is a fast-moving story.
Yeah, they're keeping a close eye on that. So will we. There is some impeachment news today that I want to ask you about. ABC News is reporting that there is an audio recording of President Trump at a private dinner in April of 2018 calling for the firing of then-ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. The president is heard reportedly saying, take her out, get her out tomorrow. And he's also reportedly speaking with Lev Parnas. That is the indicted associate of Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Again, just this week, Trump denied knowing Parnas. But Scott, it does look like or sound like this recording is in line with what Parnas has said recently in public interviews. What's your read on the importance of this development?
Yeah, I think President Trump and a lot of Republicans who are appearing in these photos with Parnas that he and his attorney are tweeting out have said, look, we take pictures with a lot of different people. We don't know who a lot of these people are. And that's the case with Lev Parnas. Now, if the audio is legitimate, then it shows Lev Parnas and his business colleague Igor Fruman, both of who are indicted on unrelated campaign finance charges. It shows that they had a much closer relationship with the president. They appear to have been attending a private, intimate dinner with the president at the president's hotel just down the street from the White House. And, you know, you can hear laughing on the audio the way it's described, as well as the president saying, these things, take Yovanovitch out, get rid of her.
Hmm. In terms of the actual trial itself, Scott, yesterday, it was kind of notable how often the House Democrats invoked the name of Joe Biden and his son, Hunter. Of course, they're part of this impeachment inquiry. Joe Biden is running for president. So you'd think that the Democrats wouldn't want to go there. Why do you think they did?
Well, I think they're trying to preempt some of the arguments that will be made by Jay Sekulow and other members of the president's team once they hand off this case and the defense steps up and begins to defend the president beginning as soon as tomorrow. And so, you know, Hunter Biden, Joe Biden are in many ways at the center of this because that's what the president says he was investigating. He wanted to get to the bottom of what he described as corruption with Hunter Biden involved in this Ukrainian natural gas company. And so Democrats know that that onslaught is coming. And so they're trying to anticipate that by saying Hunter Biden and Joe Biden did nothing wrong. That was an argument you heard from Sylvia Garcia, one of the House impeachment managers. But Republicans, including Jay Sekulow, have said this provides now an opening for us to call Hunter Biden as a witness. We're not sure where that's going to end up, whether we even will see any witnesses in this impeachment trial. But certainly that's going to be a line from Republicans going forward.
Well, in fact, let's hear from Jay Sekulow, the president's lead lawyer, talking about how they do plan on capitalizing on the Democrats' mentioning of Biden.
What I don't understand is for the last 5 hours, it's been a lot about Joe Biden and Burisma. They kind of opened the door for that response. So we'll determine as a defense team the appropriate way to do it.
So the defense team starts tomorrow. The president is kind of not happy about it. He says Saturday is the Death Valley in TV. What do you expect? We've just got about 30 seconds here.
Well, that's true. And the president obviously is a reality TV president. He has experience in TV. And so he realizes that nobody's going to be watching on the weekends. And he wants the defense to start with a bang. That's why there is discussion up on Capitol Hill about possibly pushing the defense off until Monday so that they can start with more momentum.
Scott Wong at The Hill in Washington, putting in some long hours this week. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The chatbot on Sheila's phone is supposed to ask her questions, but when she starts asking it questions, it sends her poetry.
Secret dwelling place, mysteries held in the dirt, time has other plans.
What happens when you treat artificial intelligence with love on the new episode of Invisibilia from NPR?
Trevor Noah is best known as the host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central, but this Sunday he's up for a Grammy for his stand-up special, Son of Patricia, which was nominated for Best Comedy Album.
I feel like there should be a rule in America. They should say you can hate immigrants all you want, but if you do, you don't get to eat their food. Yeah? That's a fair exchange for me. You hate immigrants? No immigrant food. And when I say no immigrant food, I mean no immigrant food, nothing. No Mexican food, no Caribbean food, no Dominican food, no Asian food, nothing. Only potatoes.
Well, Trevor Noah is also an author. Last year, he adapted his 2016 book, Born a Crime, Stories from a South African Childhood for Young Readers. It's about growing up in South Africa during and just after apartheid with a black mother and a white father. I spoke with Trevor Noah about it last June, and he explained why he thinks young Americans should know about apartheid.
Well, you know, one thing I enjoyed when I was growing up in South Africa was in our schools, we learned about world history, you know. So we learned about American history. We learned about, you know, the French history. We learned about what happened in Russia. We learned about Europe. We learned about Africa. We learned about South Africa. And so for me, I think learning about history gives you some context. It gives you an idea of what the world was like. It also gives you an idea of where the world has gone to in comparison to the past. And so for me, you know, if you read stories from South Africa, if you read about apartheid, you come to realize that racism or oppression aren't unique ideas to America, first of all. And you also, I think, start to realize that it's an all too common idea, you know, or a common theme that happens all around the world.
Well, and what has your own experience made you realize about the racism in this country? I mean, just in the last few years, we've had Charlottesville, Virginia. We've had the shooting at the black church in Charleston. Even the president calling a black member of Congress low IQ. What do you think about the level of racism in America today?
Well, I think it's unfortunately, you know, part of the fabric of the country. You know, South Africa and America have very similar histories in that fundamentally the beginnings of the countries as we know them came from a place and a time when people had certain views about people of a different skin color. And so that has traveled through time, and that has translated into laws and policies that have affected, you know, black people in America, black people in South Africa. So for me, what's always interesting is seeing what similarities there are, but then also noticing what differences there are. You know, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and that in many ways quelled any ideas that this never happened or it wasn't as bad as it was laid out to be. And I think that does something for a nation. It puts you in a place where you can't be gaslighted anymore. Whereas in America, it does feel like there's still a conversation about, is there racism, as opposed to how do you begin moving forward as a nation to get rid of the racism that has in many ways defined how people react with one another across racial barriers in the U.S.
Do you think it's gotten worse or better in this country since you've been in the U.S.?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. You know, I think some people will think it's gotten worse, and I'm careful to jump to that assumption. I think we've gotten more access to information. And so, you know, sometimes the curves of facts versus information can go against each other. I definitely think America has gotten better over time. You know, for anybody to say that 2019's racism is as bad as 1960s racism,
right,
I think is being a little disingenuous. I do think, however, social media, you know, camera phones, etc., have given us so much more access to these stories. Now, you know, you can watch a video of someone being berated by their boss, and their boss is using the N-word in the office.
Or being shot by a police officer, too.
Yeah, you'd see an unarmed person being shot by a police officer. You would never see that before. It was a story where, you know, the police could present the facts however they wished, and that would probably be the end of the conversation. So I think we live in a world where now we're getting information on a different scale, and processing that information can often mean that even though the world may have gotten better gradually over time, we're now inundated with information that tells us otherwise.
You talk about how when you were a child, because you were half white and half black, you had a difficult time deciding which group you belonged in. You even moved into different school classes to be with black students because you felt more comfortable there than with the white students. Do you have more clarity now about who you are?
I think as human beings, we're always trying to find out who we are. Sometimes the simplest distinctions to make are those that run along color lines. For myself, it was interesting being in a country where the law defined me as one race. I grew up in a different race, and for so long, people wanted to define me as whatever they wanted to define me as. And mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that clarity for me came from understanding my existence and then looking at the world around me. And I didn't do it in a negative way. It wasn't in protest or anything. It was just me understanding where I belonged and who I was, you know, because in South Africa, many people were faced with a choice. They could choose to aspire to a racial group that we were told was better than maybe the one we were. And so I think it was liberating for myself to realize that although the government had tried to define me as one race, you know, I comfortably identified with and was a black person. And that doesn't seem, you know, it seems like an obvious thing maybe, but when you grew up in South Africa, you realize how complicated it could actually be.
Can you believe that given your upbringing and all the things that you went through that you are now where you are now?
Oh, no, I don't take that for granted ever. But I like to think that I am the product of a world of impossibilities. You know, my mother is where she should have never been. You know, I think my mother made greater leaps than I have ever made. It's just that her leaps were made within her world and so maybe don't seem as grand. But I think, you know, my family, myself, my country, I come from a place where we have achieved the impossible. You know, a bloodless revolution, mm-hmm. a shifting of power from a minority to a majority without there being a mass bloodletting, I think is a really impossible story to tell, one that hasn't really been replicated anywhere else. So, yeah, I think I've come from a world where anything is possible. And so for myself, I never ever thought I'd be here because I didn't even know what here is. But I was lucky enough to grow up in a space where I was always told about what was possible. So, you know, there's a beautiful quote that I read the other day, which was, would you rather know what is real or would you rather know what is possible? Mm-hmm. And I think for me, the latter informed how I lived my life.
As you know, there are a lot of people who actually get their news from the show that you do now, The Daily Show, as they do from a lot of more comedic shows that take on issues in the news. What do you think of first of all, what do you think of your responsibility in that sense right now to inform people?
Well, I think I have a responsibility to my audience as much as I have a responsibility to myself. And that's really how I try and create The Daily Show, is I try and be as informed as possible as a human being. And then the show would hopefully be a manifestation of that information.
Well, and do you think the media right now are doing a good job in covering the news today?
Well, I think the media is too broad a term. You know, I think the curse of America is that entertainment and news have bled into each other in such an extreme way that you really can't tar the media with any one brush.
Trevor Noah, this has been an entirely too serious conversation between Trevor Noah and anybody. So just in case of that, I saved this one clip that I do want to play because you're currently touring. You're doing stand-up, and there's a part from your Netflix special that I just have to play for our audience. Here it is.
Every trap song to me sounds like a toddler complaining about life. That's all I hear when I listen to trap songs. Every time a trap song plays on the radio, I think of my little brother. He'll go outside. He'll, like hurt himself. He'll come back crying. And it sounds like every single trap song ever. He'll, like, walk in, like, and I'll be like, yo, Isaac, what happened, buddy? He'll be like,
so I'm just going to bring it right back around as we listen to that, which I love. But I'll bring it right back around to sort of where you start in this book. And you're talking about how you speak all these different languages in South Africa. In your stand-up, how much does language fit into how you view the world and even what you find funny, in that case of trap as a toddler?
Language is completely the prism through which I see my entire life. You know, for me, language is both what separates and brings people together. Language is how we process emotion with other human beings. Language is how we hear and experience emotions and ideas around us in society. And I don't just mean English and French and German. I mean even the language that we use within language. You know, whether it's body language or, you know, whether it's music, or there are so many different languages that we have and possess as human beings that help us connect or help us define ourselves in this reality. And so for me, that's literally everything that is happening to me all the time, is just a language. How do you interpret Trump's language? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the time people listen to what Trump says, but they don't listen to what he means. And a lot of the time his audience is connecting with what he means, mm-hmm. which is why they don't care about what the media reports on what he says. And so what I'm always trying to do is exist in a space where I connect with the language that people are using, and I try and translate it into a language that I can then translate to somebody else.
Well, I hope that a lot of this country's young children read your book, because I think it just – there are so many lessons in it, and it's really interesting to hear about your upbringing. Trevor Noah.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's great talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
My conversation with Trevor Noah from June. His comedy album, Son of Patricia, is up for a Grammy. Those awards are on Sunday. We've got an excerpt from his book at hereandnow.org. Hundreds of thousands of people rallied in Baghdad today demanding that U.S. troops leave Iraq. The demonstration came 3 weeks to the day after an American drone strike killed Iran's top commander, who was in Baghdad at the time. NPR's Jane Arraf is in Baghdad now and joins us. Jane, first of all, describe what you heard and saw at these protests today.
Well, there had been quite a lot of fears that this would be a protest that would try to rush the Green Zone, try to storm the U.S. embassy. None of that happened. It was a huge protest, not the million people that Muqtada Sadr had called for. Sadr is the Shia cleric who organized this protest. But there were several hundred thousand, and they were all very much on message. They were chanting against America, basically no America. They wanted U.S. forces to leave. They were waving rather unflattering portraits of President Trump, and a lot of them dancing and singing and waving the Iraqi flag.
And just remind us about Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia cleric that you just mentioned, who called for this rally. This is a name that Americans have been hearing for many, many years. But remind us who he is and tell us what he said.
So he was a young cleric in 2003 when the U.S. invaded Iraq and toppled Saddam Hussein. And then the U.S., of course, stayed. So considering them occupiers, he raised a militia to fight them. That was 2004 when the U.S. Army was fighting Sadr's forces. Young kids, you know, with rifles, shooting at tanks in the streets in Najaf and other places. So now, fast forward, he is a major political figure. He's not in Iraq at the moment. He's in Iran pursuing his religious studies. But he had a message for the protesters and for the country. Let's just listen to what that sounds like. So that is his message being read. And his message was that U.S. forces have to leave, that Iraq's airspace should not be used by the U.S., that the U.N. should help guarantee this, and also other things such as that protesters should not be attacking the U.S. or any other embassy, basically charting what he feels is a way forward for Iraq that would be free of foreign forces, particularly U.S. forces.
Now, when there have been these big protests in Iraq recently, in many cases, they do turn violent. Hundreds of Iraqis have been killed by security forces. Were there any clashes like that today?
So they've turned violent, the 3 months, more than 3 months of anti-government protests, because Iraqi security forces and Iran-backed militias have fired on those protesters who have been killed. But this group was told to stay within the park where it had gathered. They did not try to go to the embassy. They didn't try to go to the green zone. They didn't try to go to the square where the other protesters are. So all of that was averted.
Still, hundreds of thousands out in the streets rallying for U.S. troops to leave the country. We have talked about the vote that happened in the Iraqi parliament calling on U.S. troops to leave the country. Where is this headed?
That's a great question. I think the only thing that's clear is that something will change. It does not seem acceptable anymore to have even 5,000 U.S. forces in the country who are seen as having been responsible for, in some way, for killing a senior Iranian figure, and more than that, a senior Iraqi figure at the same time in Baghdad. All of that has had really severe repercussions.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf in Baghdad. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now, about to go into an American factory where a rare thing is happening. A real human being is sitting in front of a sewing machine making clothes. We're here at Good Clothing Company's headquarters in Fall River, Massachusetts, to see what it takes to make apparel in the U.S. Because as Georgetown University economist Pietra Rivoli told me last week, almost none of it is.
More than 95% of American apparel is imported. So that means there is somebody making clothes in America. There are not that many people.
But Janine Duquette is one of them. Today, the company's co-founder and an employee are checking the quality of a piece of wool. And the news is not good.
No, I would not put these two pieces together. Do you know what I'm saying?
I know.
It's going to be a challenge.
But Duquette says her team can make just about anything. Sweaters, shirts and jackets, little girls' dresses, and a lot of these.
We do scrunchies, hair scrunchies.
Really? And this is a scrunchie over here?
Yes, that's a scrunchie right there.
Okay, walk me through this. My daughter loves scrunchies,
really.
And who knew they're popular again?
If you happen to miss the 1990s, the elastic hair ties wrapped in colorful fabric were a thing.
Yeah, who knew? Because I went through the first generation of scrunchies.
Can you just walk me through this one here? Because there is one of your employees is here at an actual sewing machine, which feels like
absolutely.
A bygone era, by the way.
Want us to teach you? We could always use more help.
I would love to. But what's she doing?
Yep. So right now she's doing the side. So first you have to set the label, and then you have to fold it with it into itself so you can sew. So you're making a long tube, turn it inside out, run a piece of elastic, tack the elastic, close it up. On to the next one.
And there's some, what is this, like a pink paisley pattern or something
this
here?
This is, yep. Yeah, they call it a bandana.
And how many scrunchies do you make a
thousands.
Month?
Caitlin Bristow of Bachelorette fame designed these. She sells them on her website for $17 a pop.
So we're watching a scrunchie be made in the United States. If you were to export this work, what's the difference? Like, what does it take to make this scrunchie here in Massachusetts versus the same scrunchie in China?
The advantage to us making these in particular is that they have very fast turnaround. We need to get the fabric in, we need to get it cut, we need to get it made, and we need to start shipping. It's fast. That would not happen with China.
Because you'd have to wait for it to...
you'd have to wait for it to get here. And there's communication issues.
On the other hand, though, producing this here does cost more.
It does cost more.
How much?
It does cost more. I honestly don't know. I do know that these sell for a relatively high price. But, yeah, I would think they would probably get them for a lot less.
So why don't you want to do that? Why are you doing this instead?
We wanted to provide a venue for people who are emerging designers. There's minimums associated with producing out of the country, so you're going to have much higher minimums.
So in other words, for people who don't know the industry, that means that in order to make a t-shirt, you have to make 10,000 t-shirts.
Something. Maybe your minimum's 300. You're making product that you don't know you can sell. Because, you know, starting a clothing line is not for the faint of heart. So
are you saying if you give a designer a chance to get started with something smaller, then they might have a chance to grow?
Our minimums are 10 per size, style, and color.
10 garments?
10 per size, style, and color. So if you have one color, one size you're ordering, you only need to order 10. And you're not overproducing, so you're not going to end up sitting with a garage full of stuff you couldn't sell. We know where it's going to go.
The trash.
Duquette and her co-founder Catherine Hildebrand want to keep that from happening. They believe consumers are starting to pay attention and willing to pay more to offset the environmental costs of mass-producing clothes. It's one reason some manufacturing is slowly moving back to the United States. The American Apparel and Footwear Association says the volume of domestic garment production, although still tiny, has gone up 72% since 2009. And Good Clothing Company got its start in 2014 after this happened.
It was pure chaos. A giant plaza with a market and several clothing factories inside. During morning rush hour, it simply collapsed.
The collapse of the Rana Plaza factory in 2013 killed more than 1,100 people in Bangladesh. Many were working for big American clothing brands, and the disaster forced a reckoning across the industry. Some consumers demanded better labor standards and more accountability for ethical sourcing of their clothes.
There are certain pockets of consumers in this country that are interested in clothing that's made here.
Nancy Hodges heads the Department of Consumer Apparel and Retail Studies at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro.
The successful businesses, the businesses that have been able to actually produce garments in the United States, are the ones who are very targeted in what they produce. For example, you might have a hoodie that's made in the United States, where you might have T-shirts that the same company produces and sells that are made elsewhere. Those companies that have been very clear about who they're making the products for, and they know their customer, they know that consumer really well, are the ones that have succeeded and are the ones that are probably more bankable from a financial standpoint.
Brands like Carhartt and Brooks Brothers, they produce some products in the U.S., the rest overseas. So what would it take to bring it all back home? Hodges says it probably won't be automation.
We have not found a cost-effective alternative to a person. So automation is, you know, something that has been in the pipeline, but we're not quite there yet as far as the technology goes.
Isn't that interesting? Because we have these fancy robots that can put wheels on a car. Why can't we have a robot that puts a pocket on a shirt?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question, and I think ultimately we will get there. But if you turn any of your garments in your closet inside out and take a look at how many seams, you know, even just a dress shirt, you've got a fairly complex structure there with collar and cuffs and, you know, points where seams come together. And that's where the difficulty lies, is making it all work together and then automating it. Maybe in 10, 15 years, but not right now.
Back at the Good Clothing Company factory, Tony Aruda still uses his hands.
Those are some big scissors.
Yeah.
You don't see those every day.
That's why they're big, so they can cut across faster.
Aruda is the factory cutter. He takes big rolls of fabric and cuts them down to size. And for bigger jobs, he fires up the roll wheel.
Give you a couple of layers.
I started working on a factory as a floor boy. Then it was an opening on the cutting room for spreading when I was like 19 years old.
And how old are you now?
59.
Aruda has been cutting fabric in this part of New England for four decades, which means he has a staying power that's rare around here. Fall River was once home to more than 100 textile mills, an epicenter of clothing manufacturing in America.
That job that you first got when you were 19 years old, does it still exist anymore?
No, that's been gone a long time. I mean, yeah, back then was a lot of factories, tons of factories. You know, over the years, you know, started going overseas, and we started closing down. The factory I worked in, we used to do like pants, skirts, like three-piece suits. We ran out of work, we closed down, and it was like from factory to factory, then everything started closing down until not much left.
Do you think that this sort of work will ever really come back to the United States in any meaningful way?
I don't think that will work, because today, what I see today is young people, they don't want to do this anymore. As you see, there's not too many young people in here. On the old days, it used to be a lot of young girls, a lot of young machine operators, a lot of young kids working on cutting rooms and stuff like that. But today, I don't know. I don't know what to say about that.
Now, the owners of this factory say finding people to sit down and work at a sewing machine is the hardest part of doing business in America. The expertise, the know-how, has been exported to other countries, along with all the factories. We've got pictures of the Good Clothing Company factory, plus links to other stories we've done about apparel production in this country and abroad at Here and Now.
Florida has the highest concentration of Puerto Ricans living in the continental United States, about 1.2 million, and an estimated 53,000 Puerto Ricans came to Florida after Hurricane Maria devastated the island in 2017. Florida is a crucial swing state, and the Puerto Rican vote could be important in the presidential election. Joining us now is Fernando Rivera, who is the founding director of the Puerto Rico Research Hub at the University of Central Florida. He's in Orlando. Fernando, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So we've seen a lot of Puerto Ricans come over in recent years, especially after Hurricane Maria. But how does that fit into the history of Puerto Ricans leaving the island and coming to Florida?
In a sense, this is not a new phenomenon for Puerto Ricans coming to Florida specifically. Puerto Rico has been in a trajectory of economic decline that has pushed a lot of people out here since the 2000s. And there's been a continuous population decline in Puerto Rico. At the end of it, Florida is gaining population. The attractiveness of Florida is, you know, low taxes, better quality education, less of a crime rate, all those type of features. So those are kind of like some of the draws to coming to the state of Florida. Obviously, you know, it has impacted the communities, right, in terms of the elected officials. You can sense, feel sort of the impact of this community here in Central Florida.
And what about politically? The majority of Puerto Ricans are registered as Democrats, but do Puerto Ricans tend to be more diverse in their politics than, say, Cubans, who are pretty reliably Republican?
Yeah, that's been an issue of discussion. And remember that we have several members of the Puerto Rican communities that I might say, the ones that have been here for a while. You have a component of Puerto Ricans that have come from New York, the ones that have come from the island that's been here for a while, and the other ones that have come in the last few years. For those that are just getting here, it takes them a while to understand sort of the political process, which is a little bit different from the politics in Puerto Rico, which are related to the status of the island.
Is there any effort that you're seeing there in Florida to register new Puerto Rican residents?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a strong push by different groups to get people at least registered to vote. And now is the key issue is going to be whether not only register, but actually are they going to show up?
How do Puerto Ricans in general feel about President Trump?
Well, you know, there's been controversy about sort of the response in the Twitter accounts and the response I've been throwing out the paper towels, all those type of issues.
When he went to visit Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, he threw paper towels into the crowd.
Absolutely. And that has to become sort of a rallying call for some people that might not like his politics. But, you know, at the same time, people that are not that familiar with U.S. politics or anything like that, they might see sort of the positives of what the president might be bringing to the table in terms of economic prosperity and religious affiliation, all those type of things. So for a lot of people that might not know a lot of the politics, it seems like it follows the patterns of other voters as well, that, you know, they criticize the individual behavior of the president, but they do sympathize with some of the policies that he has put in place.
So for the Puerto Ricans who have recently, in the last couple of years, come to Florida, made a new home there, obviously they've got a lot on their mind as they adjust to a new life in continental United States. But what would you say are the main issues that they're focused on?
The number one issue here, especially in Central Florida, is housing. Affordable housing is sort of the critical issue here. Obviously, we cannot forget that Puerto Rico is still undergoing a profound economic crisis that has affected all levels of life. You know, now we see sort of the consequences in that in terms of the disaster response through Hurricane Maria and also the recent earthquakes. So a lot of people are concerned about housing, jobs, and education.
And do you think that turnout will be high among Puerto Rican voters in the next election?
Let's see who's going to be the candidate for the Democrats and what's going to be the issues that are going to be resolved or going to be spoken to. You know, so far there's been a push because it seems that Florida might be closer than people think in terms of whether it's going to go Democrat or Republican, and seeing Puerto Ricans are going to be the ones that are going to have a large say in that. So hopefully that's the hope, that people do exercise their right to vote and actually go out there and make their voice be heard.
If you were to walk down the street in a Puerto Rican neighborhood where you are in Central Florida, is it likely right now that you would look into the windows and see the impeachment trial on TV, or people don't really care about that?
I would say people know that impeachment is going on. But I think people are probably more attuned to what's happening in Puerto Rico right now in terms of, you know, the potential political turmoil more than it is the impeachment trial.
Hmm. That is Fernando Rivera, who's founding director of the Puerto Rico Research Hub at the University of Central Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And while we're talking elections, a reminder, I will be broadcasting the show from Iowa late next week ahead of the Iowa caucuses the following Monday. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.